Support for this KQED podcast comes from Bay Meadows, an urban village in San Mateo. Fitness and movies in the park, Caltrain, artisan eateries, fun for the kids, all just a hop from your front door. Homes now selling and leasing. BayMeadows.com.
Stories about the changes you don't see coming.
This is the dream that we all have, and it just happened to me.
That's On the Leap, a new podcast from KQED, launching October 6th. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins blasted his way into public debate back in 1976 with the book The Selfish Gene, and he's stubbornly refused to leave the stage since. The scientist is as much or better known for his evangelical atheism and for the way he courts controversy on stage, on television, and most recently on Twitter. He's promoting a new book, the second of two autobiographies called Brief Candle in the Dark, and we've got him in studio. Join us to talk about science, religion, and culture in a life that spans more than seven decades. That's coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. From The Selfish Gene to The God Delusion, the books of Richard Dawkins have done more than popularize scientific reasoning. They've stuck a mote in the eye of people who disagree. You could say Dawkins likes to argue for sport, but in the second volume of his autobiography, Brief Candle in the Dark, it's clear Richard Dawkins wants you, the reader, the listener, to think things through with him. And he's joined us here in studio this morning to talk about it. Thank you so much for being here.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
So your books have sold so well. I'm thinking more than 3 million copies of The God Delusion, just to name one of, what, 12 now at this
yes.
point? Are you taking a victory lap for science on this tour, or is there more work to be done, do you think?
Oh, there's always more work to be done. But Brief Candle in the Dark is not a controversial book. It's actually, it's an affectionate, humorous, I like to think genial sort of romp through the second half of my life. The first half is in my other autobiography, An Appetite for Wonder. So I think it's a funny book. It's got lots of anecdotes and digressions about interesting people, funny people that I've met. It's not arranged chronologically. It's arranged in themes.
It's very much a book about a life in science.
Yes, a life in science with lots of digressions on travel and television and journalism and just funny characters.
Well, I hate to put you on the spot, but I also know you're good at it. Any thoughts on the Nobel prizes announced today? Three scientists won in medicine for parasite-fighting therapies, and I'm curious if you've followed along.
I have not. I'm on the road, and I haven't read a newspaper for quite a while. But I admire the Nobel Committee on science. The Peace Prize, which is done in Norway, not Sweden, I'm less enthusiastic about. But I think the Swedish Academy usually gets it right. I'm looking forward, by the way, to going to Stockholm in December. I happen to be coinciding with the Nobel banquet, and I've been invited to that. I'm looking forward to that. I've got to hire a tail suit with a white bow tie for that. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I'll leave it up to our listeners to look it up on their own. Some very interesting stories from that news development.
I will look it up now you've mentioned it
yeah.
to me. I'll look it up myself.
But I thought, you know, we would just sort of pull back a little bit big picture. One of the things that these prizes often do is sort of lionize one individual and say, aha, she's the woman who did
sure.
X. Yeah. And I think in many ways it seems like a holdover from the 19th century because so much of the work in modern science today is done by teams.
That's true, and especially in modern physics, where sometimes there's a team of hundreds, literally, of people, and the person who gets the prize is often just the one who got the money to do the research in the first place. So it is a bit losing that idea of the individual genius. It's not like that at all anymore, although there are individual geniuses around.
You know, I'm curious, for the benefit of people who haven't read The Selfish Gene, the book that sort of catapulted you into the public eye, could you summarize for us what it talked about?
Well, that's a nice, easy assignment you've thrown me.
I consider it a softball, but...
you do. Okay. Well, Darwinian natural selection has traditionally been looked at from the point of view of the individual organism maximizing its reproductive success. Another way of putting that is that it's maximizing gene survival, and you can turn that on its head and say genes are maximizing their own survival. And so the individual body, the survival machine, as I call it in that book, is a tool, a vehicle for the genes that ride inside it. So if a gene is good at building bodies, then it will tend statistically to end up in the next generation and the next and the next and the next. And the way it does that is by cooperating with other genes to make the body good at surviving in whatever way that particular species does it, whether it's flying or swimming or burrowing or swinging through the treetops or whatever it is. So it's Darwinism, but looked at through the eyes of the gene. It's the gene's eye view of evolution. And what I show is that if you take the gene's eye view, you get the right answer. If you ask yourself, what would I do if I were a sophisticated gene mathematically working out what I should do in order to get myself into the future, this is what I would do. And obviously we don't think genes are sophisticated mathematicians, but if you make the assumption that they are, you get your sums right.
Now, is it fair to say that you sort of have a progressive view then of evolution, that there's a kind of intelligence, if you will, operating along those lines towards an end result of greater survivability? Because not all biologists have that idea.
Well, I'm not sure that's the right way to put it. I happen to have a progressive view. I happen to believe that evolution in general does move in a consistent direction, which other biologists, as you say, don't. But that's not a part of the selfish gene view. That would be a sort of separate thing that I hold. But when you use a word like intelligence, there is no intelligence. It's just that if you, as I said before, if you do the calculation as if the genes had intelligence, then you do get the right answer.
And is it fair to say that a lot of the successful strategies are strategies we see taking place across species, across geographic regions, because they are helpful in passing on genetic information?
Yes. I should say, by the way, that one respect in which genes are definitely not intelligent is they don't look ahead. They don't plan for the future. Brains do that. So the human brain is an organ that has evolved by the selection of selfish genes, but the human brain can do things that the gene can't. The human brain can look ahead, can plan, can see the consequences of its actions in the future, and that's a very different kind of calculation.
And I suppose it goes some way towards explaining why we have been so successful or perhaps malevolent on the planet.
It does, and it also explains why we are not beholden to our selfish genes all the time. I mean, neither you nor I are rushing around propagating our selfish genes. We're doing other things, and that's a blessed quality of humans which no other species has.
One of your common public complaints is that a lot of people read The Selfish Gene, or perhaps just read the title of the book, and determined that you're casting aside altruism as a human value.
Yes, I'm afraid that is true. It is the selfish gene, not the selfish individual. So it neither says that individuals are selfish, nor in particular does it say that they should be. It's strictly the gene's eye view, and selfish genes is very different from selfish individuals.
Why do you think the book generated so much controversy at the time it did?
Well, it wasn't that controversial. I mean, it actually received extremely good reviews. The controversy kind of happened a bit later, partly, as you said, from people who read the book by title only and thought it was either saying that animals are selfish and we are selfish, or saying that they ought to be, which it certainly never was.
Has it been a frustration to you, or perhaps you've just rolled with the punches, that so much of your public commentary has been focused on controversy and sort of fighting necessarily religionists or fundamentalists or people who are sort of looking for someone to take the part of atheists?
Yes, I don't seek controversy. I seek clarity and truth. And I suppose it's inevitable that if you do speak clearly about truth, there will be people out there who will object, people who have a vested interest in the opposite of truth. But I don't go out of my way to be pugilistic.
You only recently retired from New College at Oxford, and so I'm going to ask you to wade into another controversy that's quite fierce here in the U.S. over the rise of standardized testing in American schools. You spend a lot of time in this book, Brief Candle, talking about the process at Oxford, the process of testing, of determining who's going to be a student there, the process of intellectual engagement and development.
Yes. I'm not aware of the details of the American controversy, but certainly at Oxford, we try in our admissions procedure not to just go for people who are good at doing examinations, and that's why we do interviews. We try to interview the student for about half an hour and try to assess whether this student is likely to be teachable. We're not testing their knowledge. That's done elsewhere. We're testing teachability. We're testing intelligence. But again, not standard IQ testing. This is the specific kind of intelligence that will help them in the subject, which in my case happens to be biology. So in the interviews that I did, I tried to get a conversation going. That partly serves to reduce the intimidation factor. They're obviously scared because they're hoping to get in. So I try to get a friendly conversation going to see how teachable they are, try to not ask them questions and then wait to see if they're stumped by the question, but rather get a conversation going in which we can think it out together, go through, almost lead them by the hand through a conversation to see how leadable they are and whether they show initiative in leading me.
It makes sense, and yet I think of, you know, perhaps that data fond person who might say you can't change what you don't measure. How does one measure a qualitative human conversation?
I suppose if you're trying to assess people in a nationwide way, and then you have to have some sort of metric which can be standardized, if only in the interests of fairness. When you're actually interviewing people one-on-one, individually, you're looking for some kind of spark of originality. It's quite hard to quantify that.
I suppose it's fair to say that this system at Oxford greatly influenced the shape and development of your intellect.
I'm sure it did. I mean, I was an Oxford student myself, and I loved it. I loved the tutorial system. I loved being — this is more in my first volume, Autobiography and Appetite for Wonder, when I was a student. But I loved the assignment of being asked to write an essay every week, being asked to go into the library, which happened to be one of the best libraries in the world, and read the original research literature. So not write from textbooks, but go and read what's actually going on at the frontier, on admittedly a very narrow subject of each particular essay. But that's teaching you to be a scholar, which is rather different, I think, from the ordinary textbook-based or lecture-based education.
Sort of, you know, read, digest, and then regurgitate.
Exactly. We don't want to do that. We want to have to look for originality. We want the student, ideally, at the end of looking at the recent research literature, to be a kind of world authority on this narrow subject, to feel what it's like to be the world authority, what it's like to read what the latest thoughts are in the research literature.
You recorded an audiobook of Darwin's Origin of Species about a decade ago, and I'm wondering what it was like now that you're in your 70s to revisit this classic of science after a career in science.
I thoroughly enjoyed doing the reading of The Origin of Species for audiobook. Darwin's style, of course, was 19th century. It was Victorian style. They had much longer sentences. It's quite difficult to read. I was forced to study each sentence to work out where the stresses should lie, to work out how to read the sentence to maximize the intelligibility. So I didn't try to act the part of a Victorian gentleman. I tried to make it clear to the reader. I tried to use my understanding, based on my own knowledge of what Darwin was trying to say, to really clarify what he was saying. And it's not unabridged. My reading notably cuts out what Darwin has to say about genetics, which is simply wrong. I mean, Darwin knew the genetics of his own time, and above all, it's genetics that's changed since Darwin's time.
So explain that for us, seeing as you're an educator and a popularizer. How would you summarize that?
Well, genetics in the 20th century is digital. That's something that Darwin wouldn't have understood. He would have understood it, but that's something he didn't know. So for Darwin, heredity was a rather vague concept. Everybody knew that both the father and the mother contributed attributes to the child, but they had a vague idea of kind of a mixing of paternal and maternal effects. almost like mixing two liquids. Now, if you mix two liquids, what you get is an intermediate. If you mix red and blue paint, you get purple. And you mix enough colours, you get a dirty brown. That clearly doesn't happen. If that did happen, every generation would be more uniform than the generation before. We'd all be a dirty brown rather than being blue and pink or whatever it starts out as. So, and that would have meant natural selection was impossible, because natural selection depends on variation not disappearing. And that problem was known to Darwin. It was pointed out by a critic of Darwin called Fleming Jenkin, and it worried Darwin. And it wasn't really until the 20th century that the answer to the riddle became clear, which is that inheritance is not blending. It's not like mixing blue and pink, blue and red paint. It's like taking sacks of beads, sacks of marbles, and taking half from one sack and half from the other and mixing. They don't blend. They stay discrete.
And yet, don't they sometimes act together? I'm thinking
they certainly
actually
act
of,
together.
You know, the old adage, you know, it used to be that the metaphor used to describe American democracy was the melting pot.
Yes.
And now we tend to prefer the salad bowl. And it's not that the introduction of pumpkin seeds won't affect the taste of the salad, because it will in conjunction with other ingredients, but they also don't lose their individual properties.
That's right. I mean, there is a melting pot with respect to embryology. Genes cooperate with one another in building the body of each generation, the baby and then the mature adult. But they don't mix with respect to getting passed on to the next generation. They remain intact, uncontaminated by each other. When it comes to being passed on via eggs or sperms to the next generation, they do blend in their effects on the body, but not in their subsequent migration to the next generation.
Well, now, you've, throughout the course of your life, been very eagerly watching new developments. And I'm just curious if you've been watching some of the discoveries in genetics and biomedicine coming out of Silicon Valley.
There's a great link between genetics and computer science. And so it would be no accident that Silicon Valley, as well as being the world center of computer technology, is also a world center of biotechnology as well. My encapsulation a moment ago about what Darwin would learn today, that was limited to Mendel, who actually was a contemporary of Darwin, but Darwin never actually read him. But from the 1950s onwards, Mendelian genetics has become kind of super Mendelian. It's become digital in every detail. DNA is a computer tape. It just happens to be quaternary rather than binary. So Silicon Valley is a natural place for advanced biotechnology research.
I'm curious, just looking over the course of your own career now, because we're talking several decades, are there ideas that you had as a young man that now you would disavow?
Well, I'd like to answer yes to that, because scientists pay lip service to the idea that we learn by our mistakes, which we certainly do, and that's how science advances. I don't actually take back anything that's in the selfish gene. I think it's become more complicated, but the genes I view remains the central, I think, best way of looking at life. It's become much more sophisticated, much more interesting in that way. And as I said, it's become a branch of information technology. And that makes it hugely fascinating for me, because as I explain in Brief Candle in the Dark, I spent a lot of my life as a computer programmer. I became addicted, not in a good way, actually, to computer programming.
What are the kinds of questions you think that computer science can help biology answer that couldn't have been answered 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I think that genetics has become so much dominated by the digital idea. It's now possible to sequence the genome really rather cheaply of an individual. I mean, the original Human Genome Project took 10 years and cost huge amounts of money. Now it's possible to do it for maybe only $1,000. And from my point of view, as an evolutionary biologist, doing that for different species of organism is immensely illuminating, because now you don't have to rely upon just comparative anatomy and fossil evidence in order to reconstruct the pedigree of the whole of life. You could now just take a sample, take some blood, take some DNA, take some spit, and analyze the precise digital sequence of letters in any two species you like and work out how close cousins, we're all cousins, some more distant than others. And so we can now potentially find out exactly how close cousins we are to any other species on Earth and how close any species is to any other. And not far off knowing also how far back the common ancestor lived. There must have been a common ancestor. And molecular genetics can... It's not the only evidence you need for that, but it helps a lot in reconstructing the ancestry and when the branch point was between hedgehogs and piranha fish, any two things that you've... Or humans.
Or even other kinds of humanoids.
Who are... Well, that you mean extinct ones.
I mean, right, yeah.
Well, to some extent. I mean, the Neanderthal genome has now been sequenced by Svantopabo and his colleagues. But it's hard to get. I mean, ancient DNA is technically difficult to deal with.
Oh, we're already getting comments and questions. Bill writes, I'm reading and enjoying Mr. Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, but was surprised by an admission Mr. Dawkins made to a panel of theistic scientists. They stated the universe had to have a cause, and Mr. Dawkins agreed. I've come to question that premise. Why admit a pre-existing cause? Why not cut out the middleman, as it were, and just say the universe always existed?
Well, I think we know the universe didn't always exist because we know that there was a Big Bang which initiated the universe in which we live. Now, many physicists today have reason to believe in a multiverse, lots of different universes. And so in that domain, you might be able to say that the universe had predecessor. But there's a lot hidden in the questioner's use of the word cause. It's as though that was a major admission. That's not a major admission. I mean, what would be a major admission would be to concede that the cause had to be a conscious and deliberate one. That it was not. But whether you call it a cause or not, the Big Bang happened.
It's just not a sort of something that is anthropomorphic in essence.
That's
where
right,
it matches one of our ways of thinking. Sean writes, I used to be a big fan of Mr. Dawkins when I became an atheist a few years ago. However, I found he acts like someone who has hatred for religious people, most recently picking on a 14-year-old Muslim who used the word invented incorrectly. I wish Mr. Dawkins would focus more on science and less on fighting people on the internet.
I don't fight people. The case of this 14-year-old boy is actually quite funny. He fooled half of America, including President Obama, into thinking that he'd invented
Explain
a clock.
Explain this. This is Ahmed Mohammed, the 14-year-old who was arrested and detained in Texas.
He took a screwdriver, he opened a clock, took the works out and shoved them in a box. Now, that's not creating anything. And why he did it, nobody really knows. But nevertheless, he shows some ingenuity in managing to fool an awful lot of people, including the president and including lots of schools who've offered him scholarships and things, though he's some kind of a genius. He didn't do anything. He took the works out of a clock, put them in a box and said, I made this. He didn't make it.
It sounds like a prank a 14-year-old might do.
It sounds like a prank. And I mean, I didn't go after him. If anything, I went after the half of America, by the way, including me. I mean, I was fooled by originally until I looked into it. Why wouldn't I be? It looked as though he was a very clever young man. If he was a clever young man, he was clever in fooling people, not in making a clock. He didn't make a clock.
Should he have been suspended, arrested?
No. I mean, it's just a prank. He should not have been suspended. He should not have been handcuffed. But nor should he have been lionized and praised to the skies the way he was.
We're talking to scientist and author Richard Dawkins. Tickets are almost sold out for his talk with City Arts and Lectures tonight at 7:30. But you can join this discussion on forum. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. And, of course, tweet to us at KQED Forum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. And we're talking with Richard Dawkins about his latest book, Brief Candle in the Dark. So let me ask, you have been getting some flack for comments you made on Bill Maher's show last week. You talked with him about Islam and criticized liberals in particular for being too easy on Islam. And I thought we might just hear a clip and talk about some of that.
And so they think that if you criticize Islam, you're being racist.
Right, all right.
And you're absolutely right that the regressive Muslims give a free pass to Islam, whereas they're kind of right about everything else. I mean, they're right about misogyny and all the other good bad things in that case.
You're talking about repressive leftists, yes, liberals, yeah.
Yes, but in the case of Islam, it just gets a free pass.
So the idea there, Islam or leftists are giving Islam a free pass, and maybe it's because I live in the Bay Area, but I hear all kinds of criticism about all kinds of ideas, regardless of religious background, or perhaps because of religious background, if people are taking conservative theologists to task. Why do you think this is the case, that Islam is getting a free pass from liberals?
I just noticed, by the way, I said regressive Muslims. Regressive leftists. I think people are, I mean, I think liberals are in a bit of a bind because they've got all sorts of ideals like anti-misogyny, they believe in freedom of speech and so on. But they also are very passionately against racism, as of course I am. And if you think that any statement, any criticism of Islam is a criticism of a race, then you're torn between your different liberal ideals. All you need to realize is that Islam is not a race. It's not racist to criticize faulty ideas. Nor, by the way, are people like me criticizing individual Muslims. I recognize for sure, that most Muslims are very nice, decent people who fortunately don't take their religion all that seriously. But there's a minority that do take it seriously. And unfortunately, those that do take it very seriously often take it to the point of actual mayhem and murder.
But do you really feel as if liberals are holding back on criticizing things that are awful? I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who has not spoken out about things that are terrible.
I'm quite surprised to hear you say that. You may be following.
Is this because you're visiting university campuses and feeling?
Well, you mentioned
squelched?
University campuses, and,
yeah.
And it's there are some very striking cases where universities, not the university themselves, but student unions, have actually banned visiting speakers because they've been lobbied by the Muslim lobby in the university to stop them coming. Maryam Namazi, who is a very eloquent and humane and good ex-Muslim in Britain, was banned. Fortunately, the ban's now been lifted because of mass protest. From speaking at Warwick University, the student union said that her views might be offensive to Muslims and might give rise to too much controversy. There is a widespread attitude in universities in America and Britain that students need to be protected from thoughts that might upset them. I mean, what on earth is a university for but to expose students to all kinds of views, let them exercise their critical faculties, let them argue. Don't panic and sort of cover their ears. Oh, I'm frightened of hearing these words that are offensive to me. I need a trigger warning. Yes, I think that if you think that decent liberals in America and Britain don't shy away from criticism. I mean, they do shy away from criticizing Islam.
Well, I'm thinking, for instance, we just heard about an awful bombing by forces related to ISIS of Palmyra in Syria. You know, I don't hear everybody saying, don't say anything about it. We might offend, some people listening.
Obviously not everybody,
yeah.
but unfortunately, you'll hear a substantial number of nice liberal people who will... They don't defend it, of course, but they will try to deflect criticism. They'll say something like, oh, well, it's part of their culture. Or they'll say something like, oh, well, American bombing is what provokes it. I mean, as though American bombing provokes people to whip women for showing a bit of skin. Of course, American bombing doesn't do that. It's nothing to do with American bombing. It's to do with religion.
When you say religion, though, I mean, this gets at something over the course of your career. Some people have accused you of also being as tough or even tougher on fellow travelers with religionists as you are on people who may hold truly, you know, conservative or even backward ideas.
I'm not ashamed of that because I think the fellow travelers, the liberals, these are my own people. These are the people that I marched with against the Iraq War. These are my fellow feminists who it seems to me are giving a free pass to misogyny because it's hiding under the cloak of religion. And so I do think that we need to call those people out.
Well, I don't want to hog the conversation here. Let us go to the phones. And we've got with us right now Anne in San Francisco.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
So I am a liberal, actually, and I also am concerned about not only there's a lot of religions that have a very conservative attitudes toward women, especially women in science or non-traditional roles, and they're certainly not of only one religion. I would like to ask why Richard Dawkins so strongly supported Tim Hunt when Tim Hunt made the comment, perhaps jokingly, but it's not really a joking matter, that women should be segregated from scientific laboratories. Thank you. Thank you.
Tim Hunt is a distinguished Nobel Prize-winning biologist. He's in his 70s, and he made a joke. And it was an unfortunate joke. It was a silly joke. It was picked up. I mean, the audience at the time took it as a joke and laughed at it. He's made it very clear both since then and throughout his career that he's a strong supporter of women in scientific research. He's been a great mentor to women researchers throughout his career. Numerous women have come to his defense. He spoke out of turn. It was unfortunate. It turns out that almost the sole source of this story was a particular woman in the audience who herself has been discredited since then. She latched onto this thing. She made a huge meal of it, and I think it's a very unfortunate thing that this very distinguished scientist, who himself has been a loyal and staunch supporter of women in scientific research, he made one little joke, which was clearly intended as a joke at the time, was understood as a joke at the time by the audience, has been blown up, and an attempt was made to essentially ruin his career and his reputation. This is blowing things out of all proportion.
You could say that the public sphere, things do get blown out of proportion. Small moments become the subject of vigorous debate, and oftentimes subtlety is lost.
That's true, and that's one of the consequences of the immediate rapidity with which things travel through the internet. And I think it's something we need to be aware of.
It brings to mind, even on Twitter, where you were pointing out that this young boy in Texas had not really done a great work of scientific achievement and possibly might have been playing a little prank on his teacher, and that got blown out of proportion. But you ended up having to back off there.
I didn't back off. I mean, yeah. It was blown out of proportion in two directions. It was blown out of proportion in that he was arrested and handcuffed, and it was then blown out of proportion in that he was invited to the White House. Cool clock, Ahmed. It's not a cool clock. If he does go to the White House to demonstrate it, there's going to be a lot of embarrassment.
Well, let's keep going to new calls. Peter in Berkeley.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I have a kind of a part practical question and a part theoretical question. The practical question is my concerns about overpopulation, and the theoretical question is that I'm struck often by the discrepancy between thoughts and behavior at the individual level versus the aggregate. And the example is simply how many children to have. And most people would agree that, oh, yes, we have a terrible problem with too many people on the globe and it's not sustainable and so forth. But if you talk to the average ordinary citizen, when it's their turn to start thinking about having a family, the pattern seems to be that, well, yes, we want children, And then the first thought is followed by the second thought, that if we're going to have one, we should have two, for a variety of reasons. And, you know, at that pace, we are not going to address the global problem of overpopulation. And I'm just curious, theoretically, how do you explain this discrepancy between what the individual might think and what the aggregate consensus seems to be?
I think there's a big difference between first world and third world. I think it's an empirical fact that where poverty exists, where people are poor, where many people dying young, there you get very high birth rates in countries like in Western Europe and in America, where people can control their own birth rates. They tend to be limited. I mean, children and grandchildren are among the great joys of life, and to have two or three children is something that certainly shouldn't be denied by any kind of dictatorial legislation. I think the answer in the world as a whole is to attempt to reduce poverty and to increase education. And what tends to follow from that is that birth rates drop.
Although, let me point out what many environmentalists have pointed out, which is that we do live a more resource-intensive life here. So
that is true.
A junior born here in Berkeley, California, is going to eat up a lot more resources.
That's true.
And contribute more to climate change.
In particular, I would like to see us weaning ourselves off fossil fuels and oil. I mean, I'd love to see us weaning ourselves off oil.
Any ideas, if you want to
tell
them
out? There are people working hard to do research on renewable sources of energy and nuclear energy. The quest to get fusion power is underway in various countries. I really want to see oil take a back seat.
I think there are a lot of people in this audience who would love to join you with that thought. One listener writes, "What is Professor Dawkins' view on the meaningfulness purported in the research on near-death experience and or Oliver Sacks' hallucinations?"
Near-death experiences have been extensively examined. They're physiologically understood. They do not imply any kind of afterlife or anything of that sort. It's very, very hard to see how an afterlife could possibly arise. I mean, we know that consciousness, everything about our thoughts are to do with brains, and brains die, brains decay.
And brains perceive what is happening around them in language that is familiar. So
yes.
When we're trying to understand a new phenomenon, we might turn to, say, you know, a great Aunt Bess who died many years ago, and might turn to her to feel good about something that's frightening coming upon us.
Yes, you might. Yes.
Christine in Mountain View writes, "My family has been poisoned for decades by fundamentalist evangelical dogma. Your work has always provided a reality check and a safe port in a storm. I want to convey my gratitude for your insights over the years."
Well, thank you very much. In addition to my books, I've got a foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, which is an attempt to educate and raise consciousness about the importance of evidence-based reasoning. So,
and am I right in thinking that one of its initiatives is to encourage atheists to go into politics?
Not only that, but also encourage politicians to recognize that the non-religious community, we're calling it actually openly secular rather than openly atheist, and you can be secular and religious at the same time, just you subscribe to the Founding Fathers' belief that religion and politics should be kept separate. I think there's a widespread misconception that politicians have to pretend to be religious. Of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, it's simply not statistically conceivable that they're all religious, yet they all claim to be, which means that every single member of the United States Congress is either religious or a liar. I don't blame them for being liars, because they think that they've got to lie about being religious in order to get elected. The openly secular campaign, from my point of view, is trying to convince them that they've got the wrong idea. The secular community, the nuns, the people who don't believe in any religion, is now exceeds 20% of the American electorate. That means that's more than any other particular religious denomination. So you're sucking up to the wrong people. And we need to convince politicians of that, that there is, it's not just the Jewish lobby and the Polish lobby and the Catholic lobby and this lobby and that lobby. There's also the non-religious lobby, which is as strong as any of those. Listen to them. Listen to us.
Well, thank you so much for that comment, Christine. Let's turn now to, let us see, Vicky in Butler, Tennessee.
Hi there. And I just want to say, Dr. Dawkins, you're one of my greatest heroes. My question, over the weekend I watched The Unbelievers, in which you mentioned the idea of the intelligent design of morality. And I was just curious as to whether you intend to write a book about that, because it immediately made me think that that would be a great title or theme to a book about morality that I have considered writing, okay, but I don't think I would have ever thought of the intelligent design of morality, but of course I don't want to steal the idea. So
well,
that's very
that.
Gracious of you, Vicky.
Yes, very nice. The Unbelievers is a sort of full-length documentary featuring the physicist Lawrence Krauss and me. The phrase intelligent design, of course, is normally used to refer to the design of living things. I perhaps slightly mischievously hijacked the term for the intelligent design of morality. Many people think that morality comes from religion, and it clearly doesn't. I mean, if it did, we'd all be whipping people for breaking the Sabbath and that kind of thing. So our morality comes from somewhere else. Why not apply the idea of intelligent design to morality? Let's sit down together and work out what kind of society we want to live in, what kind of morals we value. And that's actually sort of what we do, not in quite such a direct way, but moral philosophers, journalists, radio discussions, dinner party discussions. These are all building towards the improved morality. And morality does improve as the centuries go by. There's no doubt about that. It's beautifully documented by Steven Pinker in The Better Angels of Our Nature, by Michael Shermer in The Moral Arc, both superb books, and both demonstrating that moral values increase as the centuries, even the decades, go by. It's nothing to do with religion. It's to do with a lot of other complicated factors.
Is it getting better, or is it simply socially constructed and our social values have changed?
Whether it's socially constructed or not, it's getting better. And we are much nicer than we used to be. Not only do we not have slavery anymore.
In some places.
Indeed, you're right. But it's getting better, not in all countries at the same rate as in any other country, as every other country. But we don't have public executions mostly, though they have them in Saudi Arabia. We don't have public whippings. They have them in Saudi Arabia. And various other places. But on the whole, globally, over a great sweep of historical time, things are getting better. It's nothing to do with religion. It's a secular improvement that goes on. And those two books I've mentioned are very good books. I might write one, but don't let me dissuade the caller from writing her own.
Well, maybe there's some kind of co-authorship deal you guys can work out together. Thank you so much, Vicky, for that call. Aaron in Pacifica writes, as a theist, I disagree with Mr. Dawkins in many areas, but I nearly cheered when I heard him lament the state of our universities. Higher education is failing to encourage respectful debate in the false hope of protecting everyone's sensitivities.
It's almost too respectful. That's part of the problem, especially when the respect goes one way only. I think universities need vigorous debate. They need it has to be respectful, but it can be vigorous. It can be strong, clear thinking, and above all, don't suppress free speech for fear of offending people's sensibilities. Universities should be the last place where you have censorship because people might be hurt. Poor little things getting hurt by hearing things they've never heard before. What a pathetic approach to university. Grow up.
Let's turn again to the phones. We have, Neil in San Francisco.
Yes. In reference to what you just said, I'd like to know why it is that the most intensely atheistic societies on our planet have also been among the most viciously repressive. Stalinist Russia, Mao's China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, North Korea, all of them are very atheistic societies, yet there's certainly an obvious absence of public morality or official morality in any of those countries.
Yeah, this is a widespread misconception. It comes up over and over again. Sometimes even Hitler's added to the mix, who, whatever else he wasn't an atheist. It may incidentally be true that Stalin was an atheist, that Mao was an atheist, but to suggest that the horrific things they do had anything to do with their atheism is an utter travesty. They, in fact, in many cases, erected a kind of new religion of their own, not evidence-based, based upon worship of, it might be Stalin. Stalin was certainly worshipped. Mao was certainly worshipped. Or worship of an ideology. And the particular Marxist ideologies were riven with the idea that the end justifies the means, and so the good of the party, the good of the proletariat, whatever it was, this is a theological idea that you do horrible things because the end result is going to be some kind of a utopia, some kind of a heaven on earth.
There's a narrative and a hierarchy where one group of people is more valuable than another.
Yes. It's horrific what those people did. It had nothing to do with atheism, nothing to do with rational thought, nothing to do with critical thinking. We need critical thinking. We need to criticize that kind of dictatorship just as strongly as we criticize the celestial dictatorship, which, as Christopher Hitchens pointed out, North Korea, he made a special point of that this is clearly a theocracy, albeit not a supernatural. It almost is supernatural because, they worship the first president as a kind of god.
But thank you so much for that question, Neil. And now on to Giles in San Jose.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to pass along a note of appreciation for Professor Dawkins. I felt much of the time that he's preaching to the choir in my case. But one thing that really stuck with me was your note that rather than refer to, you know, Muslim children, to say children of Muslim parents or children of Christian parents, I've always felt that sort of really calls out the indoctrination that kids go through when they're brought up in any sort of religious household.
Well, thank you for that, and that's a thing I do feel very strongly about. You wouldn't dream of talking about a logical positivist child or an existentialist child, a Gramscian Marxist child. And yet when it comes to talking about a Catholic child or a Muslim child, the whole of our society is perfectly happy to hear a phrase like that, tying a label around a child's neck when the child is too young to know what it thinks. There's a bizarre story a week ago when a mother was handed her newborn baby by the midwife. And the midwife said, "What religion is he?" So the mother said, "He's too young to answer that question."
I guess we do this in many ways. Yeah, I'm thinking even to choose a religious example, Pope Francis comes to the U.S. and Americans want to know whether he's a Democrat or a Republican.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's we look to put labels on people.
Yes, that's a kind of insularity. We do look to put labels on people, and labeling children in particular with things that apply only to people who have got time. I mean, being a Catholic or being a Muslim is a whole package of thought about the world and morality and things. And to label a label around a child's neck, I think that's a form of mental child abuse.
What do you think of the reaction the Pope has gotten on his visit to the U.S.? It's almost as if he's a rock star.
This always happens, of course, yes.
It didn't happen with Pope Benedict, though.
Well, he wasn't a very nice man. I think it looks as though Pope Francis is quite a nice man, unless he really is a wolf in sheep's clothing, which some people think. But yes, I mean, it's not difficult to understand why he would be treated as a rock star.
Thank you so much for that. Let's turn now to Akeem in San Jose.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I caution on the use of the statement that the world has become more moral. I get nervous because we've entered an era in which a little red button is pressed, a missile goes across the oceans 5,000 miles, and whole cities are annihilated. And then as if that's not enough, we put a camera on the tip of that missile and then upload it to YouTube. And then that goes viral. So I just wanted to get your opinion on that in respect to morality.
Yes, well, that's right. And I think if you, I mean, those books that I mentioned, say Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature or Michael Shermer's The Moral Arc, they're talking about the broad sweep of history. And there are, it's more like a sawtooth. It goes up and down. I mean, clearly the two wars of the two major wars, the German wars of the 20th century, were horrific reversals of the major trend. But even allowing for that, the per capita chance of dying a violent death at the hands of another human being go down progressively century by century. Of course, we have to be aware of those reversals, and the reversals in our own time are the ones that should capture our particular attention, because they're the ones we can do something about. So you're right about that.
Is it better to think about morality, though, as maybe an ongoing discussion?
Yes. It's an ongoing discussion. That ongoing discussion must take account of the reversals that are happening in our own time. But that doesn't negate the point that those two authors are making about the broad sweep of history starting in prehistoric times.
It does seem, though, that new technologies bring with them new moral questions, the capacity to do horrific damage.
There's much greater capacity to do horrific damage. But if, say, you compare the Second World War, where both sides were carpet bombing civilian areas. Nowadays, the technology for bombing has become much more sophisticated. It can be precisely targeted, smart bombs, with the result that although it's horrific what's going on, it is precisely targeted. And when a civilian target is hit accidentally, the perpetrators, even Donald Rumsfeld, will go on and will apologize, or at least say this is collateral damage. Whereas in the Second World War, that was the point of the exercise. I mean, Dresden was bombed to intimidate the population. Coventry was bombed to intimidate the population. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. There was nothing about collateral damage there. Collateral damage was the name of the game. It wasn't collateral. It was full-on damage to intimidate the civilian population. That's a big change.
And yet I wonder, you were talking earlier about wanting to see an end to the oil age. Oh, it sounds like the end of our... We could continue doing this for another 2 hours. I do want to encourage all of our callers and emailers to continue the conversation online. And I want to thank our guest, evolutionary biologist and author Richard Dawkins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.